Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Here we go again with another Spin the Rally Pod, your rally fix, as we wait for our sport to restart. I'm rally fan Lisa Rose Sullivan, joined by the expert crew who know all about spin. Voice of rally, Colin Clark. Good morning, Colin. Are we awake?
Only just, Lisa. It's an unearthly hour for a podcast. Only just. Good morning, though.
Former sporting team director George Donaldson is raring to go. Morning, George.
Good morning, Lisa. Yes, I am raring to go, and I am reminded as we speak, sorry to drag this out, I'm reminded as we speak of all the times I've shared little flats with Colin on rallies, and I've thrown him a coffee in the morning. We're talking secondhand, we're talking grumpy, and then finally excited as we're heading out towards some patisserie somewhere where he can get his second coffee and some delicious little thing to eat, which, okay, I share his excitement for that 100%. Great to hear you, Colin, Lisa.
Thanks, David. George.
Yeah. I've got no baked goods to offer you at the end of this one, Colin, so you're just going to have to wait for that caffeine fix to hit in. And, of course, we can't do this without Dirtfish senior staff writer David Evans. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Lisa. I've got to say, I do feel as though we're making a podcast breakfast show this morning. I feel like Simon Mayo or somebody, or perhaps John Humphreys.
Thanks. Great,
probably
mate.
Not. I think I'm overplaying my part there, aren't I?
Chris Evans. Point. Chris Evans is good. You got the same hair as Chris Evans.
Shut your face, Clark. Get back to sleep,
Colin.
Well
and truly burnt there, David.
Well, this is perhaps the nearest we can go to making you feel like you're on event by getting you up at some ridiculous hour. We are going to be talking today, though, David, at your suggestion, about Safari Rally, because that's what we should be talking about. We should be, you know, reveling in all things Africa and getting all excited about the history and the return and Safari Rally, but of course due to
we're
the
not.
Long-term problem we're not. So we'll relive it in our heads. That hasn't happened.
Absolutely, and we will relive it on dirtfish.com this week, of course. But yeah, you're exactly right, Lise. Astonishingly, even though it feels like it should still only be April or May, it is July the 13th. Crikey, Monday the 13th. Yeah. And yeah, we should all be heading south to Nairobi, to Africa, and to the first Safari Rally since 2002, which would have been hugely exciting and will, of course, be hugely exciting next year when we get there. But yeah, it's another one of those just bizarre events, isn't it? That
it is.
You kind of can't believe that this year's happening.
And you know what? David, I know you've done a number of safaris, and George clearly is the king of the safaris, but I've never been. And it's one of those events that I really, really was looking forward to. I don't know if I told you guys previously, but when I was younger, I used to read everything by Wilbur Smith, and Wilbur Smith says a lot of his books in Africa, and you know, reading can instill a passion, and I have an absolute passion for Africa, and I was so looking forward to it. But as you rightly say, David, we'll be going next year, but still, it's a massive disappointment.
I used to work with a cameraman who was named after Wilbur Smith hero, Dax.
Yeah.
His name was Dax, which I've never heard of before.
Yeah, proper strange kind of old school hero names.
So we're back to 2002 since the Safari Rally last ran. George, were you there?
I certainly was, and it was the most disappointing Safari Rally I had ever done. First time I was ever in a team where all the cars had retired, and that was Pro Drive, and it was just unbelievable. And it was the same similar problem as happened the previous year. It was, I don't know. I still struggle with that one. It hurts me yet that we retired from that event. I've had hard Safari rallies, but never retired.
When did you join Subaru?
I joined in 2001.
So you didn't get a win with Subaru then?
I didn't get a win with Subaru, no.
But you got a few wins with Toyota.
Interestingly, I was there in 2000 as a spectator because Toyota had stopped at the end of 1999 and I was in Formula One, but I had heaps of holiday built up over a number of years, really, to take back from the team, well, from the company. So I had about 40 odd days holidays in spare, and I took a whole load in January, and then I took another 2 weeks or week and a half or something to go out to Safari Rally. Wow. I had lots of air miles as well at that time, so I went out to Safari Rally and
air miles.
I of course all my former friends and colleagues were many of them were still involved, of course, and I got on very well with John Spiller, the team manager of Subaru at that time, whom I eventually took over from. But John was fantastic, and we spent a fair bit of time obviously out on the section spectating, and then in the service park, as it were, just listening to their radios and sitting in their little under the little awnings, drinking tea or whatever it was we were drinking, and eating their food and being part of their team almost in a strange way. It was brilliant. Mm. And they won that. I think it was Richard that won that, wasn't it? It was.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So George, back in 2002, so you're saying you had 2 years in Subaru where the cars didn't finish. Were they still building in those days specific Safari cars? I know they'd have to be modified, but you know, back in the day when you guys at Toyota were putting so much effort into it, cars were built specifically for the rally. 2002, was that still the case?
Not so much the case. Basically, the way that Mitsubishi did it, which we've heard on our podcast so well from Derek Dauncey, is that they basically just figured out how long a part would last and changed it pretty well every service, you know, and managed it that way. At Subaru, basically very similar. You did make the car a bit stiffer. You made it as high as you could, so you're trying to get as much suspension travel out of the car. Very long sections, quite fast, and the roads are mud roads as opposed to, as David said on the last podcast, and I didn't take him a task for it, he said, oh, these are man-made roads, so I've never seen a natural road formed naturally, but the environment, the geography doesn't do it. But I know what you meant. I mean, a beautifully man-made road or just a gravel, a mud road. So in Kenya, they're mostly mud roads, just a road carved through the bush with no substrate in it to make it stronger. So you get massive ruts, you get massive holes that form from little rivers and arrows I forget how you pronounce it, Arroyo, little ponds and puddles and temporary streams. So you get these huge bumps and dips and ruts. So the car suspension does take a hammering. So you get as much suspension travel out of it as possible so that the suspension absorbs the shock and it doesn't get transferred to the chassis and break it into two pieces, which we've all seen on Safari Rally. So yeah, they do those modifications, but fairly minimum. The cars were kind of strong enough as they were, those World Rally cars, but
I have to
not,
say, George,
clearly not
that what you're describing there, and David, you'll have seen them as well, the videos that we saw coming out, a friend of ours, a guy called Jeff Mays, who actually works on one of the wildlife estates out there that one or two of the stages were running through, he sent a number of videos through of recces through the stages, and they're very similar, George, very similar to what you described there. So I do wonder how much the teams, how much obviously M Sport and Hyundai and Toyota, how much extra they would have put into the existing cars. David, well, I didn't hear anything about that.
They're very limited. I don't think homologation wise, you can't do very much. You would just adapt the car to give it as much travel as you could. Basically, the Safari Rally that we were going to have this year is kind of like the last two that we had. Well, actually, the last five or six that we had, in that it's a service park. In this case, it's a single service park, not moving around at all, but they were quite creative with the route, so they're using the area around Suswa basically to the north of Suswa and to the west of Lake Naivasha.
So it was a rift valley, wasn't it, George?
The whole of Kenya is basically rift valley, but it is as you drive out of Nairobi north up towards Naivasha and Nakuru, where the rally's going to be based, you climb up a vast escarpment and you're going through a pine forest, and honestly, there's times when you're going up there you could easily be in Scotland or Scandinavia, and you're thinking, where am I? This can't be Kenya. This is not Kenya. Everything's completely green, and you get right up to 7,000 feet as you drive out of Nairobi. You're starting at 5, you go up to about 7,500 feet, I think it is, up there. And then there's a place there up there, just a little lay-by. It's the Rift Valley Viewpoint. Mm. And it's compulsory to stop there. And you will be offered soapstone trinkets from the little vendors there. But the most amazing view out to the west over Longonot Crater, and in the distance, Suswa Crater, Suswa Volcano, which is a huge volcano, which doesn't look like anything when you look at it. Longonot Crater is a much smaller one, and it looks utterly classic. And you look down into the caldera about, I don't know, 10 kilometres away. It's fallen to the side of the viewpoint. But you look right into the caldera on this extinct volcano, and you're at 7,000 feet. And then you have this incredible, almost a pastiche of looking down at the Rift Valley and all the little down the sides of the valley where there's lots of moisture. There's huge amount of little patchwork of fields and small agriculture. And then you get down to the plain, down to the bottom where the volcano is, and looking right across to I forget the name of the little town on the other side. So it's looking across towards Narok, about 60 kilometres away. The escarpment goes back up the other side, and that is the Rift Valley, as you can see, or a little part of the Rift Valley, at least, because the Rift Valley is huge. And it's just the most amazing thing to see. Sorry to rant on, but as you can tell, Africa is very much in my blood. It's gorgeous.
I've got to say, I absolutely agree with that, George, that when you're driving up through that forest, you could be anywhere and you could be in Scotland. Yeah. But then equally, I do remember getting to the top and stopping in that viewpoint, and there was definitely something that reminded me that we were not in Scotland when the monkeys or baboons or whatever they were jumped on the car.
There's no baboons up there at the viewpoint, is there? I've never seen any. Baboons up there.
I'm
seen
sure
them on the way up through, but you see them on the way down.
Well, exactly. They were very large. What scared me
more than that was our friend again, Jeff Mays, kept sending little videos of the stage, but then he'd occasionally send photographs of prides of lions and things at stop lines. At stop lines. Say this is the stop line for stage two, Colin. How'd you fancy this one? Yeah, not very much. Thank you very much. I'll be sitting in my car.
This is a man who used to get worried about wee beasties that you'd see something rustling that was probably the size of a dormouse, and on the radio side of things, I'm thinking, something coming.
Yeah, it's a bear.
Do you remember
it's
the bear? The bear.
Yeah, I remember the bear. In Japan.
It was a mouse.
In Japan, it turned out to be a very large dog. It was a dog, a very large dog. In the distance, it could have been a bear. And that was all Denny Girardet's fault, because I'd seen Denny Girardet that morning, and he was doing some work for Subaru, and he'd been through the stage that we were on. It was actually the stage. Remember the stage where Petter Solberg crashed, the penultimate stage of the rally around Japan? He'd been going up the hill there, and that was a stage that went up a valley to the top of the hill, down the next valley, back down again. So you had to go up the one stage to come back the next one. And he'd been driving through at about 4 a.m. and had followed a bear for about 500 metres. This bear just ambled along in front of him, just, you know, a bit like something out of, what's the film with the bears, with Baloo the bear? I want to be like you. Yeah, a bit like Jungle Book, you know, driving along with this bear. So I had bears, I'd seen him, and he told me the story, and I had bears in my head all day. And then I saw this bear and got really very excited and looked a little closer. Yeah, it was a dog. It was a dog, a very, very, very big dog.
Spotted Japanese dog bear.
Yeah, those were happy days. Happy days. That's another one, Japan, to look forward to. But guys, you know, safari, and it is something very special. It's something very special in terms of the history of the World Rally Championship, because it's so different. And for me, it really does typify why rallying is so special, because your sport's about diversity. Formula One is fantastically exciting at times, and we saw that this week with that race in Austria. But you know, we go to these incredibly different settings and venues and different challenges every month for rallying, and nothing really typifies that more than the safaris of old, I suppose.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think the real classics, of course, were all through the 70s, 80s and the early 90s. I think that's when we started to see the specialist cars coming in. Pre that, they tended to be, I suppose, the late 60s, but they tended to be Austin Healey's and Volvo P544s and Saab 96s type things.
Saabs, I love Saabs.
Production car adapted for rally. And then we, of course, we saw the Mark 1 Escorts. The Minis were never strong enough, never enough suspension travel to survive a safari. They did try, the factory cars did try a couple of times and failed hopelessly.
Wow. Tiny Subarus?
The Subaru Vivios.
Colin used one, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
94 or 95.
He thrashed it to death. I think it lasted about a day and a half, which was about, honestly speaking, because I remember speaking to him before the rally. I said, Colin, how are you going to play this? He said, I'm going to kill this. He said, it's quite strong. He said, I'm just going to thrash it. And I reckon he could have got a remarkable result if he'd finished. And I remember discussing it with him, saying, look, you know, why don't you just like try and shepherd it a little bit, but you know, use your speed where you can and be smart with your notes and everything. And he looked at me and said, yeah, that's quite a good idea. Nah, I'm going to thrash it. We did actually have that discussion, I do recall it. And he did, he killed it about a day and a half, which is probably a day and a quarter longer than he expected, to be fair.
But one of them finished it. I think Patrick Njiru drove one as well.
Patrick Njiru they did it quite a few years.
Did
Richard not do it in one as well?
No, I think he did it in a Group N car, didn't he?
He did it in a Group N car, right. Bretza, yeah. I don't think he finished either. I can't remember. I remember the first year that Richard came. They came, Robert had phoned me. I'd given him my phone number in the workshop in Nairobi. It must have been, would it have been 94? 94, something like that. I guess it would have been about then. And I'd given him my phone number, said, look, you know, when you arrive, give me a call and come along. So he did. He came into the workshop and he looked at all the Group A Toyotas and we chatted. And I said, come on, we'll go back to the Sereno Hotel for lunch. And in Nairobi, you know, the traffic was the traffic. So it was basically a race back to the hotel. It was pretty horrendous. Anyway, I can honestly and legitimately say that I have raced Richard Burns and I've beaten him. I can tell you, he was very determined. It wasn't an easy one. It was a tough one, Lisa. Don't belittle this win.
I'd take it.
This was a sub-world championship win. But I mean, we were on pavements, across the parks, all sorts of nonsense that you could do back then. It was great fun. Good lunch. Talking to Richard. Richard was fun. Sorry, have we digressed off track here?
No, we haven't, George, because I think one thing that we do have to talk about is the Uhuru Highway and the road coming in and out. It's this one main road that comes in and out of Nairobi. I think probably goes right through Kenya, but I only drove a certain section of it, but it's the first and maybe not the only time. I remember some of this in Jordan as well, but you would be driving in the dead of night, not the dead of night, but it went quite dark quite early, I remember.
Starts the dusk is about 6:35, 6:40,
yeah,
and complete pitch is 5 minutes later.
Yeah, that's right.
There is no dusk and there is no dawn. There is a pre-dawn light and then bang, it's there. It's like out of a movie set when someone just turns the lights on.
But it just an incredibly dark road, obviously no street lights, and it was a two or three lane, probably a three lane motorway, the nearest thing that in those days that Kenya got to a motorway. And you'd be driving your hire car up there quite slowly, and you'd pass the odd person walking down a central reservation on the roadside of it. And then happily, you'd either come across a huge plume of black smoke, you'd slow down a bit and find a truck going incredibly slowly with no lights, hopefully going in the same direction as you, but more often than not coming in the other direction towards you.
Honestly,
it was, at the time, it was absolutely terrifying. But looking back, it was completely just part of the adventure.
Can I ask about the actual rally side of things? We talk, when I hear you guys talk, obviously you're talking about how robust the cars needed to be to actually finish the event. What kind of time gaps were there between the cars as they were finishing the stages? Were they close? Were they tight?
Yeah, they would be sometimes 10, 15, 20 seconds, sometimes a minute, sometimes 2 minutes, sometimes 5 minutes,
But George, the other thing that we saw was, I remember sitting watching, I think it was Safari, Channel 4 were covering it, and it was on a Saturday night, they had an hour's programme, remember sitting in the kitchen watching it. And it was fantastic coverage. It really was. 2003 or 4, probably. We saw from the helicopters. Fantastic helicopter coverage. And seeing really back in those days that you could take different routes almost. The roadbook, obviously, there were long sections between instructions and the roadbook. So I remember McRae, and it's quite famous footage, isn't it? McRae, the roadbook or the stage was supposed to go down through the riverbed, and it was a really bumpy, rocky riverbed, and he decided to stay up on the bank and he went right across the grass. And things like that could, I suppose, affect times massively. But that, again, must have been part of the allure, the attraction of the safari, the fact that you did have to make those decisions. You don't make those decisions anymore. You completely stick, and, you know, the rule is two wheels on the road or you're penalised, aren't you? But in those days, you could be well off what was considered the road as long as you were following the instructions in the road book.
You probably find that wasn't the riverbed that they were driving down. It just turned into it had turned into a riverbed because of the cars going over it and the trucks. So you quite often find five or six routes. You know, you have a main sort of artery where you're at point B and you're headed at 180 degrees, 20 kilometers down the road, not quite straight, but there may be five or six roads. You know, sometimes several hundred yards apart, all going down there. So you pick your road. I remember that one in particular because it was, I think it was up, I think I've got a feeling that was up on the Mau Escarpment, and or that area, could be completely wrong, but the road was quite well defined, as you said, in this almost like with banks on the side, almost like the Azores Rally, really, you know, with the high banks. And he just completely deviated up, and there was quite a few people that was obviously near a main road, and there was people in there with their with all their pickups and Pajeros and also Mitsubishi Shoguns, as they're called in this country. But yeah, Colin just literally hopped up over this bank and moved off 50, 60, maybe even 100 metres out to the left and zigzagged through other tracks. And he continued to do that for 5 or 6 kilometres. And was he overtaking somebody at the time? I think he actually, did he not pass somebody?
Quite,
I think,
possibly.
He might have done. Yeah. He might have actually passed someone, which makes it an easy pass, because passing on a gravel road in the dust is, you know, nigh on impossible. You're going to have to find another route. And your helicopter can help you in those circumstances. Mm. So the helicopter can see a way, but the helicopter flying along at 50, 60 miles an hour, sometimes even, you know, nearer, you know, 160, 170 kph, 100 miles an hour plus, they can't see all the potholes and bumps because they're getting a two-dimensional look straight down at the road. They'll miss everything, but it can be huge help. Allow the driver to pick up those little options.
Do you think, you know, it has been, I say 2002, George, the last 18, 19 years, it'll be 19 years certainly by the time we go back next year. Is there a chance that we're going to be a little bit disappointed?
Well, I was thinking that we were, Colin. It's a great question. I was thinking we were. And then one of my old friends, Glenn Edmonds from Safari Rally, from Kenya, actually, not, he wasn't necessarily part of the organising team on Safari Rally back there. I met him at Andrew Cowan's memorial service, and it was a sad event, but of course, as always in Scotland, there's always a jolly get together afterwards. And I got myself half an hour with Glenn, and Glenn showed me all the route, and we went through it, and I'm looking at the old sections up across Hell's Gate from the Naroks, from Lake Naivasha across to the Suswa side, and then back again. I'm thinking, hang on, okay, these maybe aren't 90 kilometre sections, but they are sections. They will be a challenge. There'll be no different. These roads will not be better than they were previously. So yeah, David, your earlier question: how much will they be? How much extra will the teams be doing for the cars? Well, I don't think they're allowed to. The parts are homologated on the car, so it's going to be up to the drivers to shepherd those cars to get them through. Otherwise, they're going to be getting towed back later, super rallied, and back out there again.
But they would have done some of the really cool safari bits, wouldn't they, George? They would probably put the extra lights on them and maybe some rubars on the front and the odd snorkel. I mean,
again, I'm not sure if you're allowed to do that under the homologation.
From what I was told, there was certain dispensation for this event.
There was. Okay, so just what you would absolutely want to do, David, is you would want to get the car as high as you possibly could. Not to the point that you don't have any droop on the suspension, because droop's just as important as compression. But these cars have huge suspension travel, as we've seen. You know, you see the cars jumping in Finland, and you know they land like a cat after effectively what might be a 3 or 4 meter drop over the piece. They've maybe never been more than a meter above the road, but they come down, they land like a cat. So we've got great suspension already. Hopefully that will be strong enough. I'm sure it probably will be. It's just a matter of having your start point a little bit higher, so you will use that suspension in quite a different way. Now, that's a massive engineering task. That's a complete redesign of the way the shock absorber is going to work. I'm quite sure of it, because it's not designed to do that. It's designed to keep the car really low in the centre of gravity. gravity low. You don't want to lose all that, but you actually want to be able to drive over rough stuff quickly. And I'm sure the teams will have sent people out for recce, so I'm sure that somebody's been out and around on the stages, and that the teams know what they're hitting, and they'll have figured out what they want to do.
New generation George Donaldson.
Sure, they'll have done that. So,
but what we also should remember there, George, with the suspension, is that we talk a lot, and you know, we always remember the really slow bits of Safari, but there were some really, really quick bits where
unbelievable.
Where you've got the car high up, and you know, uh-huh, the car the sort of center of gravity is high, you get a lack of precision, don't you, on some of those
the car moves around. You know, when you get up to 130, 140 miles an hour on a hard gravel road, and there are hard gravel roads with the odd little rut here and there that you have to lift the car over. Literally, you'll drift it sideways and then pop it up over a set of ruts to the other side of the road. And I've seen it being done at 130, 145 miles an hour. Fred Gallagher once on a test, which I was at in the Group B Celica, so that was 1986. They were doing a tyre test, and it was up about a 15 or 16 kilometre section of road from near Naivasha back up towards Elementaita Crossroads, it was called. I can't quite remember the length of the section. But Bjorn was driving the car up there, turning at the top and coming back down, and Fred had calculated the average to the start-finish point that we had, it was a rolling start-finish, a flying finish, obviously. I think we ended up with a flying start on it. But he was working out that they were doing, it was 143 miles an hour average up and down.
God.
And that car, I think, could do 148. It had lots of power. It had plenty of power for Africa. It's a flat, hard road. So it was, you know, the road wasn't absorbing terribly much power. And we were seeing what the car could do. And that's why the Celica won originally. It won because it had top speed and it had huge suspension travel. And the suspension was unbelievably strong. But it was more like a group. It was more like a Group A car than a Group B car, almost Group N plus, because, you know, it was an old Atlas axle in it. It was front suspension arms were not handmade. They were other suspension arms from something that had been modified, strengthened, beefed up, different ball joints on it. It was all stock parts, even on that Group B car, or not stock, but shelf parts, shall we say. So yes, very, 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 very high speed sections. It's really a lot about speed, but it's also about the ability to be doing that speed, being good enough with your pace notes to catch where the ruts and changes are. And I mean, our recce is very tight into the rally. It's only a couple of days before the rally, so unless there's been a massive amount of rain, nothing will change that much. But you know, spectators will be going up and down the road. Extra ruts will appear. There will be extra bangs and belts, and you know, these are public roads. Trucks are using them. A truck could get stuck. They'll dig it out. You're driving up the road at 100 miles an hour, and you're finding there's a 20 meter wide, 1 meter deep mess in the road. You know, your car's going to need to be able to take that, I'm afraid. Otherwise, it's going to wipe its bottom and just sit there with no wheels, awaiting recovery later.
It's probably worth remembering, George, as well. Before 96, before 96, the roads were open, weren't they?
They were open after 96 as well. They weren't closed until the very end.
Were they?
Yeah, they were still open. Still people driving down them.
But I mean, it's just remarkable, isn't it, that you'd come.
That's why we had the wing lights. The wing lights were the identity for a rally car. So the wing lights were, in theory, first of all, to stop that, so you had a light that was above the mud level.
Yeah.
And that was a very valid point. The first four Safari rallies I went to were completely dry. Kenya never saw much rain for 4 years when I first went there.
Were those back in the times when it was at Easter, though?
That was an Easter event,
Was the rainy season, wasn't it?
It was just before the rains, but the rains could come, yeah. So that, the theory was a late Easter put you in danger of rains. But back in 1986, Kenya often has droughts, even though it's in this fantastic subtropical zone. And, you know, Kenya is the food basket of the world, of Africa. I remember, basically, you go into the supermarket in Europe now, certainly in Britain anyway, you go into Marks and Spencer's and the Tesco, the green beans you'll be eating will be from Kenya. Mm. And they would have been picked in the field yesterday. They are packed on site down in the fertile area around just south of Nairobi and up in Naivasha. Absolutely the area that we're going to. Lots and lots of greenhouses as well. And not that they're necessary, really. The whole country's a greenhouse. But you do see them. They grow flowers in them as well. So all the flowers that you see in Amsterdam, they're all coming from Kenya. than you now. You know, but they're packed in the afternoon. They're driven down to Nairobi. They go on a night freighter and they arrive in Britain at 5 or 6 in the morning. And they're out in the shops on the shelves by 10 o'clock. And by the way, I've been in one of those packing plants, and you can see them. They're even labelled. They've got the barcode labels on them, the sell by date and the price in pounds stamped on.
Wow.
In a factory in Naivasha. It's bizarre when you first see it.
That's another thing to add to my list of adventures. I'm going on safari and I'm going to a bean factory.
But also, Carl,
as well.
Also,
I want to see
also
it.
We're going to go to definitely going to go and see the good Dr. Dawa at Carnival's restaurant, which was an absolute blast.
Look, I can do you an adventure. I'll do you an adventure, Colin. This lovely big volcano I've talked about, Suswa. Now, the rally is running around there a little bit. It doesn't go right around Suswa, but it's doing a fair little bit around there. But there's some old tracks, and I've got a lovely book that describes, what is it called? I think it was called 50 Tracks in Kenya, and it was to unusual places. And up on this Suswa, this old volcano, there is massive caves, lava tube caves.
Ooh.
So you can drive up there, and it's 20 kilometres up this real proper goat track, and literally you're pushing your way through the bush.
Yeah, I like that, George.
I've been into those lava caves and they are spectacular.
Yeah, all right. But that'll come after.
They run for 20, 30 kilometres. Stunning.
That'll come after Dr. Dawa and Carnivores.
Hot springs. We're running through Hell's Gate Park. There's lots of gorges down there. There's hot springs popping out. Well, there's huge thermal power stations there in Hell's Gate Park. So, it's all edgy stuff, you know.
That'll all come before Dr. Dawa and eating crocodile and ostrich. And it is.
But this is what I want to hear about, David. I want to hear about the drinks.
It was all fabulous. It's all Tusker beer. It's all there waiting for us. But one thing that makes me a little bit sad about Safari Rally is that, you know, you look at the history of the event, and it's one of those rallies where local drivers could always do incredibly well. I mean, the last one, we had the people like Ian Duncan, but before that, it was Jaginder Singh and Shekhar Mehta and all these great, great names from days gone by in cars like Datsuns and these kind of things. And there won't really be any scope for that anymore. And there hasn't been in the sort of latter day history of the Safari. Obviously, the last WRC round there was 2002. And unlike George, my memory of 2002 is magnificent because it was another Colin McRae win. But it was a typical Colin McRae win that he just completely controlled the event almost from, I don't know, midway through the first day or something. And it was back in the time that I think I was still working for Motoring News then. And David Williams was there reporting on the event. And DKW used to write Colin's driver column for Motoring News. And I remember we were...
But did Colin not write that himself?
Yes, of course he did.
Just, you've shattered
and
that
we were sort of midway through the penultimate day, which in those days, I think it was a three-day event, just like every other WRC round. So we were midway through Saturday. And there was not a lot to talk about because Colin was just cruising and driving quite happily. And so Colin said to DKW, "Should we do the column now?" So confident was he that he'd still got half of the safari to go. But he was supremely confident in the car. You know, those focused... The Malcolm Wilson's Focuses that he were driving, they were absolutely bulletproof.
Lovely cars. Brilliant car, that Focus.
Yeah. I mean, you look at, we were up at M Sport last week, Col, and one of the absolute best memories that Malcolm has is of the 1999 Focus, which astonishingly, after, I think they'd had two events, Monty and Sweden, where they'd been fastest times, but there'd been issues with that brand new Focus in 99. Then they went to Safari and won.
An amazing, drive from Colin, and that was a brilliant car, brilliant car.
It absolutely was. So but my point there was that there's not really the local flavour in terms of drivers anymore, is there?
No, there's not. But I think that's money related, totally, of course. There's no other reason for it. You know, those cars are not accessible. I mean, if we were in a car that you could buy for £200,000, I think you'd find the local importers would be spending the money on the local drivers, the Patrick and Judus, or the replacements for Patrick. He'll be out of it now. I would imagine even Ian Duncan would try and get back out and just have a little go again, and you'd be surprised how well some of these guys might do.
But that's it, you know, it was so much of that event was local knowledge, wasn't it? You know, you talked about the rain there, George, and when it did rain, because there was a lot of volcanic ash around, it would become like that. They called it black cotton, didn't they?
And
it
black, would just black cotton, yeah.
And to find a way through there was as easy for the locals as it would be for Elvin Evans to find the grip in a wet dovey or something like that.
They would automatically do all the time what Colin did, what you saw Colin doing, going off route. Colin Clark, that's you know what you saw McRae doing there was exactly what the locals could do all the time, and they had learned the roads off pat. They'd been down there all their lives. They knew that when it rained or when it was a bit damp, go off to the left. If there was a lot bigger downpour, go off to the right, but go behind that particular flame tree and keep going for 400 metres, and then there's a wee track to the left and down. And it's kind of, I suppose there was a bit of that. There was a bit of route finding going on, a bit of an adventure. And those guys didn't have helicopters, the local guys. Our guys did latterly, so it was quite exciting. But we were talking about the cars earlier, and of course, as usual, I digressed and got completely off track. They will be allowed to make changes. The biggest thing of all in Safari for me right now with these modern cars, I would have the biggest, strongest sump guard I could get on that car. Not necessarily heavy, but I would have a seriously big, thick sump guard that can A, absorb shock, and B, not come off the car. Sump guards coming off rally cars is something that I've seen a little bit of in the last 15, 20 years. Occasionally the sump guard comes off the car. I mean, that car should be able to roll down the road, be a banana, and that sump guard should still be on the car. And I think that will protect them massively. As for all the I mean, I imagine that one of the dispensations will be able to remove a lot of the front air dam, but you know, the first rough bit you come to, it'll all be gone anyway if they've not got that. Better to design it in the first place and keep some airflow than try and maximise your airflow, because it's just going to get wiped off, unless of course they've managed to pick unbelievably smooth roads. But when I saw the map, I looked at sections that had been there in Safari since 1953, and some really, you know, three or four nice little proper wee sections that are going to be very challenging, especially for the cars, and they're going to be fantastic. The footage we're going to get is going to be, you know, the creative guys in TV, all the cameramen. You know, I think they're the big losers from the. We've all lost our Safari Rally and we're bemoaning it. But those TV cameramen, what an opportunity for them to flex their creative muscles. They'll get great shots with Suswa Crater in the back, Hell's Gate National Park they're going through, Lake Naivasha, Lake Elementaita with all the flamingos on it, and the sulfur waters with all the colours on it. Just amazing opportunities, and you know, they've got the wherewithal. They would have the most stunning footage that they will get, but don't be disillusioned about how wonderful it is. Africa's Africa. It can bite. You know, those wild animals we talked about. I can tell you several stories of people, you know, out for a walk. People getting blasé about the fact, oh yeah, there's lions, I'll just walk around the corner. No. You don't do that.
Are you saying they didn't come back?
I'm saying that they didn't come back. But bits of them
didn't come back.
No, all of them didn't come back. But lions are very, very gentle killers. They don't actually bother killing you. They just sit on top of you and eat you alive. And if that's not horrendous enough for you this time in the morning, you're a tougher person than me. Fred Gallagher told us, I was sitting, I maybe shared this story down at Taita Hills where Bjorn had been out on recce. He was doing a big lap out to, I think up to, to Loitokitok from Taita Hills. It must have been about 100 kilometres up there. And I think, did he come back down over Chula? I can't have done that much. But anyway, he was going to be away for about an hour and three quarters. So we'd testing parts on the car. So we'd fitted all the car up. We retired into the hotel. One of us had to stay by the radio. I think actually what we'd done was we'd taken a battery out of one of the vans, I think out of my van, and we'd taken the radio down by the pool. So we're sitting there, all the boys are just having a nice cool drink down by the pool.
That was your idea, wasn't it, George?
Taita Hills. No, I was junior at that time. This would have been 1987. I think it was the first year of the Supra, as I recall. And after 2 hours, we hadn't heard anything on the radio, and we're wondering whether the radio's working. working well enough by the pool. And 3 hours pass, and well, okay, look, the deal is we don't go looking, we stay here, they find their way back to us. That's the deal. Okay, fair enough. I'm sort of thinking, should we go out and start looking for them? But because we know where they've gone, so we could easily do that in the van. But anyway, we didn't. We waited. And then all of a sudden, Fred Gallagher appears. I think I was sitting up in the van when he appeared. And he got out of this tourist van, as you might expect. And he was white as a sheet. So I was sitting in the, I was sitting on a bunch of tyres outside the, so we're in the hotel car park about 50 metres from the hotel towards this little airfield. And Fred Gallagher comes out of the van and he said, I've just seen a whole load of lions there at the end of the runway at the on the blind corner there. I said, oh crikey, and I'm sitting here in the van, you know, 40, 50 metres away from them. You know, I'd been half asleep. They could have come and had a meal with me. Not a problem. Nobody else around. But Fred had been on this tourist bus and he'd said, just drop me off at the bottom of the main road and I'll walk up. And the driver had said, no, I'll take you up. He'd driven up and around this corner and here's this pride of lions, like 15, 20 lions just sitting there. And it's a blind corner. There's bushes all the way up and then you turn the corner, literally 90 degrees, and it's 50 metres across the middle of the runway, or I think towards the top end of the runway, actually. But you're certainly behind the turn point, so you're in front of the turn point, effectively. The airplanes cross that road when they're taking off and landing. Lovely sign saying, look out for the planes, you know. Anyway, Fred would have turned that corner out the bushes and been confronted with a pride of 15 lions. Now, you could go back down to the main road where there's nothing. There's no shelter. There's no house to nip into, nothing. He certainly couldn't cross the way. What would have happened to him, you know? And you don't think about it. I mean, that was a road we drove all the time. It's just right outside the game park where you see lots of lions. You don't think about it. You didn't think about it.
I'd think about it, George. I think
we didn't think about it. And I remember Fred, he was as white as a sheet, saying, Jesus. He'd more or less insisted, because he'd been in the back of this tourist bus, he was looking to stretch his legs, you know. Bjorn had stayed with the car, and actually, no, I think Bjorn stayed with the car, but he got a tow, because the car did arrive back just as we were getting ready to go. Bjorn arrived on the end of a tow rope, getting blown its engine.
Well, Georgie,
again.
Right.
But
George,
anyway, that same place, whole load of scorpions. We were working on the ground, no ground sheets. And I remember somebody kicking over a stone, saying, you shouldn't be on the ground here. What are you talking about? We've been coming here for several years and we never had a problem. He said, the scorpions everywhere. Never seen one. Kicks over a stone next to your foot. And here's this lovely little clear, small, but completely translucent scorpion. Maybe it's about 3 or 4 centimetres long, not a really big one. But apparently they're the worst.
They don't need to be big, George. They don't need to be big. George, listen, as you know, George and David, I have a penchant for hiring convertible cars. I think when we go to Nairobi next year, I'll not be hiring a convertible. I really won't. I can't see them. I'd love to be able to get that beautiful full vista, you know, from a roofless car. But the thought of something jumping in with me is just a little bit too much.
Or chewing through the roof.
Well, there is that.
There's many, many national parks to go to. But if I was making a recommendation to anyone that's looking for just 2 or 3 days safari after the event, out to Wilson Airport, onto an airplane, about a 55-minute flight in what could be an old DC-3, Douglas Dakota, converted with gas turbine engines, or de Havilland Dash 8, or a little twin otter aircraft, or even something more boring like an F-50 or an older F-27, very noisy. Fly out to Masai Mara. There are lots of hotels, Serenas, river camps, really, really nice hotels, camping hotels, basically. Some of them are rooms. You might prefer the concrete room type, calling up on an escarpment.
I'm into my camping, thank you. I've got a sense of adventure.
Well, there's no history of lions ever entering any tents and stealing people, Colin. There's no record of that at all, because the people that were taken by them never reported it, oddly enough. But, you know, take 3 days, you will see everything. It is amazing. You'll even see rhinos, but you'll never see a rhino on its own. It's always got somebody with it. It's always got a man with a gun with it, protecting it, which is very, very sad, but very lovely.
Sad.
That the Kenyan government and the Kenyan Wildlife Service puts 24-hour guards on all the rhinos. And as a result, the rhinos, they have a relationship with the rhinos. These guys, you know, they're friendly. They are gorgeous. They're
I'm not going to go and say hello to a rhino. That's
well,
for sure.
I have done, and I was quite scared, Colin. I've got a video of this with myself and one of my colleagues, Norman Burns. We'd gone out after we'd done a clear up in before Christmas. We'd gone out to do a clear up in Kenya, bring a whole lot of stuff back, and we had 2 or 3 days spare. Right, come on, we're going off. We went out to the Mara, and we went on this. We were in a minibus like everyone else. Off out, found the rhino. There's the guard, and there's the rhino, and we walked around it with the guard, and we came within, I don't know, 10 meters of this rhino, and it looked at us and it started to snort and make a bit of a noise. It's huge. I don't know what a rhino weighs. Is it a couple of tons? It's a huge thing, and it's a gorgeous, almost prehistoric beast, and quite elegant in its own way, very refined looking creature with this massive horn on the front, of course, double horn. And I'm thinking, holy cow, it's coming for us, you know. And it stomped its feet and it came towards us, and I'm standing there filming this, and I said to the guard, who was a very friendly chap, I said, at what point do we run? He said, no, he said, not a problem, just stay here. And this guy has his rifle over his back, and he's got this long sort of stick, flexible, like this little twig that's probably a metre and a half long, and he's using it to, you know, with a few leaves on the top, he's using it to keep flies away, just flipping it through the air, as you might. And he reaches down and picks up a little pebble. Now, this pebble was the size of a stone chip that you would get in your garden, you know, a centimetre square sort of type thing. He picked up this wee stone, and this, by the time this rhinoceros got to within 5 metres, I was getting very scared, as was everybody else in the group. We were all huddling sort of somehow closer together and trying to shuffle back, and the guard saying, no, don't move. And he takes this wee stone and he flings it at the rhino, and it bounces off his nose and it goes, oh, and backs away, and it almost shakes its head and just takes a few steps backwards and then goes back to grazing. I think I said, what happened there? Still don't know what happened, but obviously the rhino was chastened by the guard and it went away. How good was that?
Fabulous. Amazing. I have to say, I am missing the fact that we're not having safari, but I can't wait for it to be on the schedule next year. Now, we are running a little bit out of time, but Colin, David, you need to tell us about your trip to M Sport last week.
In fairness, Lise, I don't think we do. I think we have we have a whole load of videos coming, don't we, Cole? Why don't we just say we went and we experienced fabulous Cumbrian hospitality. And
we have to say that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it was
do.
Wonderful.
But it will all, you know, just stay tuned to dirtfish.com and you will see everything and literally everything. The old, the good, the bad, the future, it's all there.
Oh, okay, George, that's us.
I'm not accepting that. Are you suggesting I've talked too long as normal?
No, not, that's them just being coy and very pleased with themselves with their trip to
I think they're wanting breakfast, Lisa, is what they're actually wanting.
That is.
They want to get their second cup of coffee.
No. It was a great trip, and as David says, we've got a whole lot of stuff coming out from Cumbria, but it was certainly good to see it's been a tough time for them up there, that's absolutely for sure, the past 3 or 4 months, but it was good to see the planning for the future and the optimism that's still there. And I think a lot of people have concerns, don't they, about lots of companies at this time, but it was really, really good to see and to feel the optimism. But as David said, it's all to come on dirtfish.com over the coming weeks.
Dovenby Hall is an absolutely amazing place, and anyone who's been there will know what a special feeling it's got there. So I'm looking forward to seeing all those videos on dirtfish.com. And if you have been interested, if you've really enjoyed reliving some of George's safari experiences, there are more on the website as well. And if you click through, hopefully, David, you're going to put this in the little blurb at the top, you should be able to go back and hear not only George's reminiscences of the 1990s and Safari Rally, but also Derek Dauncey as well, here on dirtfish.com. So I highly recommend you go back and listen to that. It has been great for the last hour or so. I feel like I've been back on the Kenyan plains and the Kenyan valleys. Yeah. It's just been absolutely brilliant, George. Thank you very much. Thank you, David. Thank you, Colin.
Thank you, George.
Thank you,
thanks,
guys.
Thanks, Lisa.
Great win. Thanks very much.
Just to wind that one up, I'm sure that Safari Rally, when it comes, is going to be great. It will be sufficiently different to have maintained in a much smaller microcosmic form, but it will feel like a Safari Rally. It will be different. It will be wonderful.
And you'll be able to hear about it all on dirtfish.com.